Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes, and with me for the first time ever is Jenny Hayes.
Hello. Good to be here.
This is quarantine day three.
It feels like day seven.
Well, whatever it is, the state is kind of on lockdown. We're not allowed to leave our homes. Luckily, we have the podcast equipment here, and so we can come and give some, hopefully, ideas or things to think about in this time that's going to help your mental state as well as perhaps your golf game. Jenny, thank you so much for being here, taking the time out of your day.
Yeah, you know, I don't have much else to do. I'm just going back and forth between my different hobbies that I can do at home, which include reading, knitting, scrolling through my phone. Been watching a lot of Instagram stories lately.
How much time have you practiced putting?
Zero.
Have you thought about making any changes to that?
We do have a putting station, I guess you'd say. Andy's been putting a lot, but I'm not really feeling like I need to putt right now.
Okay. Well, at least you have the uniform on. You've got the backwards hat. You're here for the podcast. I noticed you put on your marathon medal for the podcast. Do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah. So last year I ran the Chicago Marathon, and this year I'm training for the New York Marathon, which I never thought I would be accepted into because it's about a 2% chance. And yesterday when I was out on a run, I was just thinking to myself, you know what? Every time I go on a run, I should come home and put on my marathon medal because, I mean, what a better way to psych me up for this next marathon. I mean, the training process alone is months long.
Yep. But you didn't go on a run today, though. You just put the medal on.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, for this podcast, I'm just feeling like, what better than, you know, wearing my medal, making me feel like a champion to prime myself for the listeners.
Yeah, great. Okay, so let's get into it. This is the first episode in what's going to be a little bit of series on the mindset or mental part of golf. And today we're talking about the hero's journey. Do you know what the hero's journey is? I haven't told Jenny anything about this. I've just asked her to sit down and put her hat on backwards.
I feel like I've heard about the hero's journey just because I majored in English literature, but I don't really remember much about it.
The hero's journey is an idea from this guy named Joseph Campbell, who noticed that there was this kind of pattern or this archetype that occurred in all sorts of stories across the rest of time or across time, like Greek literature, in like the Bible and the Old Testament, in stories and movies and things that we have today. The hero's journey has, there's kind of 12 parts, but it goes in like three acts. The first act is called the departure act, where the hero leaves what's called as the ordinary world. The second act is the initiation act, where the hero ventures into unknown territory and is birthed a true champion through various trials and challenges, and the return act, where the hero returns in triumph.
So I feel like that sounds like my marathon journey.
Mm. Cool.
Just saying.
Well, it's, yeah, so that's the idea, is that this idea or this pattern occurs kind of in everyday life and occurs in stories. And so seeing it and noticing it and being aware of it hopefully can help us understand the world and understand golf in a better way. This is not really related to golf, but Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah, I know the movies.
Family favorite. It's a book and a movie. this follows the hero's journey as well. Stage one, the departure. There's a call to adventure where Harry leaves behind his life with his vicious aunt, uncle, and cousin in the Muggle world. When he receives and reads a letter from Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry asking him to enter the magical world on his 11th birthday. Step two is the refusal of the call, because Harry says, Hagrid, I think you must have made a mistake. I don't think I can be a wizard. Part three, supernatural aid and advice from a mentor. Harry has a number of friends and mentors who guide him along his journey. The most prominent among those are Dumbledore, Hagrid, Ron, and Hermione. Hagrid helps Harry begin his journey and introduces him to the magical world, assisting him throughout the course of the story. Four, crossing the threshold. Harry must leave the Muggle world behind to enter the wizarding world. He crosses the Leaky Cauldron threshold with Hagrid and crosses the barrier to platform 9 3/4 with the Weasleys. Part five, the belly of the whale. The final separation of the hero from his known world, where Harry appears ready to transform and willingly enters with the help of the Weasley family. Stage two, the initiation. The path of trials. Once Harry enters the magical world of Hogwarts, he's faced with a series of challenges that test the strength of his character and ability. Some of the obstacles that he encounters include the Sorting Hat, performing magic, making friends. Part two of stage two, the temptation. Temptations that Harry faces include joining the Slytherin house, flying, and pursuing the mirror of... What was the mirror called? I don't know. Magical mirror.
Oh, it was called Erised because it was desire backwards.
Oh, thank you very much. That's why you're here. Number three of stage two, the ultimate boon, like the time the hero either wins or loses. The rewards at the end of Harry's journey include defeat of Voldemort, the protection of the Sorcerer's Stone, and the House Cup victory. 10 points to Gryffindor.
Great books all around.
Yeah, but that's not the end. Stage two, there's a return. First part of stage three is the refusal of the return. Harry does not want to leave Hogwarts because he does not want to return to the Dursleys and because he feels at home at Hogwarts. Part two of stage three, the magic flight. Harry returns to the Muggle world on the Hogwarts Express. The next part, crossing the return threshold. Harry travels back through the entrance to platform 9 3/4 and leaves the wizarding world to return to the Muggle world. Seeing the Dursleys marks his return to normal life. Part four, Master of the Two Worlds. After completing his first year in the magical world, Harry has conquered life in the Muggle world and the wizarding world. He changes as a person and becomes a hero. That is the hero's journey.
Incredible. Love those stories. So good. If you need something to read during this quarantine time, I highly recommend Harry Potter.
Why do you think I brought this up in relation to golf?
Well, I feel like golf definitely has its ups and downs. You know, every round is going to be different, and you're going to struggle. You're not always going to do your best. Sometimes you might have a shot that feels like a winning shot. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to come back to it in practice. You have to just try again. Otherwise, you're not going to get better.
Yeah, that's true. Tiger Woods, I think the story of his life also has some pattern of the hero's journey as well. The first part, the departure, or like leaving home, I'm calling the years of 1995 to 2008, where he's this golfer prodigy, the best golfer in the world, wins every single tournament. But he's also kind of a jerk. He only cares about winning. He's rude to other players and the press and doesn't really have any friends. Really just cares about himself. Part two, the initiation act, which is, I'm going to say, 2008 to 2018, really. The path of trials. And a lot of trials, scandal, divorce, etc. And there's temptation. Was there a temptation to, I don't know, to kind of go back to his old way of life? Temptation to maybe quit golf? I mean, he took a lot of time off of golf, partially due to injury, but partially, I think, just needing a break from everything. But then kind of like the winning part of it is he comes back in 2019 and he starts smiling more. He seems nice to people. He's answering reporters' questions. And then he finally won the Tour Championship in the Masters. Great comeback.
Incredible.
But then there's the final step, the return, where he comes back a changed person.
Yeah, I could definitely tell a difference in Tiger today. You know, I... our dog here is just doing circles. Growing up as a kid, I watched Tiger with my dad, and I thought he was really incredible. Just an amazing talent. But like you said, Andy, I never really felt like I connected with him as a person. I always felt like he was kind of like a shadow self. So now I feel like we're getting more of like who Tiger is and more of his personality, and he's trying to connect more with people, which honestly, if you're not connecting with people, I mean, that's got to be a tough job, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the key part of the hero's journey is you like come back to your old life, but you're changed in some way. And I think that's what we see now, where he's kind of captain of the President's Cup. He's friends with these guys like Ricky, Justin Thomas. He's kind of their mentor and friend now. That great scene when Justin Thomas made the winning putt in their match at the President's Cup and they smiled and hugged. I mean, it's like a different person than we've seen before, where he used to just all be about business. So the, like in Tiger's scope of hero's journey, he's the master of kind of both worlds, of the golf world, but also kind of just like this more mental, emotional or spiritual world that he was lagging behind. Do you buy it?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's what we've seen.
And so the reason we bring this up as the first part of this podcast is that seeing your life or seeing golf as a hero's journey kind of can maybe bring some more sense to some of the things that are going on. Without this perspective, when something bad happens or you hit a bad shot, you go through a slump, anything of that nature, you kind of tend to think like the whole world is going to end. You don't really see that the bad parts are actually part of it. Like, they're meant to be there. Like, none of these stories are very good if Harry just gets a letter from Hogwarts, decides he doesn't want to be a wizard, and just stays home. There's no story without the conflict.
Right. To be fair, with Harry Potter, though, I kind of feel like he really went through some big things. So, you know, defeating that troll in the dungeon, things of that sort, you know, killing evil powers. I feel like it was a bit more of a bigger deal than the hero's journey of our lives, but
obviously,
keep it in perspective.
It's not a true, Harry is not a true story. But still, the idea is still the same, that these things happen to us, and I think our natural tendency is to kind of resist them and run away from them and think that kind of something is broken and something is wrong, when actually it's like the conflict. It's these things that come up that actually make the hero into the hero.
Yeah, I would say too, it kind of reminds me of high school, when you have that mentality that like every moment is huge and, you know, what am I going to wear to the dance? That's like the biggest question. Who are my friends? Like, how cool do I look? And all those things matter on such a magnified scale. And then you move on, you get past those 4 years and you're like, wow, none of that really mattered. Like, and then you have, you know, the opportunity, of course, to find your true self away from that.
Yeah. I mean, we all have those stories where we look back at them now, like when we went to Zambia in college and our bus almost hit an elephant. Like, an elephant was crossing the road and we were going 60 miles an hour and the bus almost hit it. And it was really scary at that moment. But then, like, looking back on it, you almost have some more perspective. And it's kind of like a funny story. Like, these horror stories of, you know, you could imagine someone who was, like, camping and it rained for 2 straight days and they were miserable. Mm-hmm. But now, like, a year later, as they tell the story, it's actually, like, a funny story. And it's something that they can look back upon fondly.
Yeah. I was on that bus in Zambia. It was pretty crazy. One story that comes to my mind is when I was in high school. I know I keep going back to it, but one night I decided I wanted to go to Perkins, which is a diner that stays open all night. And so I decided I wanted to go there with my friends. You know, I was probably 15 or 16. I'm like, I'm just going to stay out. My parents didn't give me a curfew. I'm just going to stay out here. Like, I can hang out as long as I want. And I ended up coming home around like 2 a.m., my parents were super upset the next day because I'm sure they were up listening, waiting for me to come home. And, you know, I wasn't doing anything wrong, but all of a sudden I needed a curfew. I needed this 12 p.m. curfew. And it felt like them giving me that boundary was like the end of the world. But, I mean, it wasn't really. Is that a good story?
I don't know. I'll have to let the internet decide.
Yeah, so anyway.
I have two quotes from, or one quote from Joseph Campbell and one idea from him. The first quote is, "We must be willing to get rid of the life we've planned so as to have the life that's waiting for us." We must be willing to get rid of the life we've planned so as to have the life that's waiting for us. What do you think that means?
You know, I think when you make a plan, it doesn't always go the way that you want. I actually hate planning. That's like the opposite of my personality. I'd rather go with the flow and figure things out. I think it's kind of beautiful. But I think he's really saying, like, if you create this plan for your life, you're kind of pigeonholing yourself. You're kind of like putting yourself on one track, and you might be missing out on so many other opportunities and experiences.
Yeah, and I mean, things never work out the way that you think. And I think right now, with being quarantined in our house and having all businesses close, is an example of that.
Yeah, this is the weirdest thing I've ever experienced, for sure.
And the hard thing is, like, we're right in the middle of it. We're not, like, past it. We're not, like, 2 years away from it where we can look back on it and laugh about that however long we had to stay in the house and how crazy that was. Or it's like, now we're actually just, we're stuck here and we have to figure out, like, how do you live in the midst of that?
It's weird because I feel like I never realized that, like, it's a privilege to leave the house and go do things and be outside. And I feel like as Americans too, with these big viruses, you know, H1N1, SARS, I remember all those, it always felt like it was really far away and it never affected us. So I honestly wasn't paying attention to coronavirus till about a week ago. I had some friends over and they're like, "Wait, you're not stocking up? Like, this is coming. This is real." So, yeah, it's a shock for sure.
We should tell people you shouldn't stock up because there's plenty of stuff at the grocery store.
But I mean, you know, you got to have a little bit extra so you don't have to go to the store
every day.
Every day, every couple days.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, we went on a walk with our dog the other day and someone, like, walking by on the other side of the street, like, said hi to us. I think that was, like, the first time that's ever happened since we've lived in Illinois, because whenever people go on a walk, they just have their eyes down and they never say anything or notice anyone else. So,
yeah, it's weird. It's like a joy to see people. It's like, oh, hi, we're out here too, you know, and we're all in this together.
Yeah, so it's definitely a horrible situation. You would never wish it happened. But if we can view it with the right perspective there, you can get some, you know, silver linings in the midst of it. Maybe back to golf. What's the hardest part for you learning golf? How long have you played golf?
3 or 4 years? Longer?
Probably longer.
Maybe 5. I feel like the hardest part is knowing and remembering how to swing the club every time, because you've given me so much advice, and every time we go out, I feel like you have great pointers and great tips. It's like, hey, remember, bring your club out. Don't keep it so tight. You know, all these different little things. And for me, when I go out there, sometimes I'm just in my head. I'm like, oh my gosh, wait, what did he say? What do I need to remember? And there's all these little things I'm trying to do instead of just hitting the ball. But with all that said, I do feel lucky to have a coach with me every single time I play.
So what can you think of a time when you were the most frustrated?
Probably the first time we played was the most frustrating because I just assumed that it was going to be easy. Sometimes I do get a little upset with Andy's help and I'm kind of like, back off, like, I don't need, you know, all this advice today. But I don't know. I think I've really kind of settled into the game now, so I don't get as upset. But I also, you know, I play for fun. Like, I never keep my score. I don't even think about my score. I try to get like five on every hole, and Andy will say, oh, you got a par on that one, or here we go for a birdie. And I'm like, oh, cool. Great. So I think I do a good job keeping it light.
I'm looking forward to our upcoming awareness episode so you can be a little more aware of yourself.
I have a terrible awareness.
The reason I ask about your golf is that how can we view golf, or maybe a round of golf, or your journey or learning golf? Like, how can you view that as a story? I think if people could view it in that way, it would help them enjoy it more or have a better experience and also kind of play better golf. Because I think whenever we go out, we have a plan or we have a hope for how the round's going to go, how the day is going to go. Maybe this is a certain score. Maybe it's how you're going to hit the ball. Maybe for you, it's like, I hope this doesn't take too long. Maybe it's how fast the pace of play is going to be. Whatever. You have this idea and this picture of what's going to happen for that day. But then, of course, like something happens that throws you off. Mm-hmm. And so I guess then the question is, if you can view it this way as a story or as a journey, like what happens when that thing throws you off? What do you do? I mean, for me, you know, my problems are different than your problems, but I was working on hitting a draw with my driver last year, which is like curving the ball from right to left.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if I've ever, I'm sure I've hit a draw, but not on purpose.
Not on purpose. So. Yeah, it's okay. And I was practicing it a lot. They were playing this round at Harborside. And I worked it on the driving range, and I was like hitting the draw every time. Draw, 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 draw. And then I get up to the first tee. It's wide open fairway, like really wide open, like biggest fairway in the world. And I hit a huge slice that goes way to the right, like onto the next hole. And it's like at that moment, it's like, well, what do you do? Do you fight that shot? Do you try to hit a draw again on the next hole? Or do you try to fix the problem? Or do you like kind of roll with it? Do you adapt to it? Do you say, oh, maybe my ball is going to go left to right today instead of right to left? And you just hit a shot. You just like aim further left than you otherwise would have. Earlier, when I would be in college or high school, I would spend the rest of the day trying to like hit that perfect shot. And I would end up losing tons of strokes because I wasn't like adapting or wasn't playing, you know, the game that I had that day. And it ends up causing you lots of strokes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think sometimes too, you know, once you get up to that moment where you're at the tee, you feel so much more pressure. And so I think one of the biggest challenges is to kind of like use the pressure or like let go of it a little bit. I know that I play a lot better if I'm less tense. Like a lot of times I'm holding the club so tight because I'm just trying to like force it and be perfect. And oftentimes when I loosen up a little bit, then I can actually hit a better shot.
Yeah. Also, there's times where you're playing great or have a solid round going, you have a bad break. Like you hit a shot that takes a horrible bounce, hits the cart path and goes into the water. It goes out of bounds. Like it hits a rake. Something weird things always happen. But there's a difference in how people respond. I think most people, they kind of spend the next 9 holes like worrying and complaining about that bad break they got.
Yeah, it's weird too because I feel like I've played with people where their energy changes and it affects my energy because then they're just really pissed off and they're in their heads and then I'm like, I can't relax and I can't have like my same round. So it's interesting how it affects other people.
That's a really good point. Maybe this one's for Steve Schreck, our friend, coworker. He really wants them to change the rules. So if your ball ever rolls into a divot, like you get to take it out of the divot.
That's a great idea.
But it like never happens. It never happens. But when it does happen, this happens, you know, in college tournaments and anything, a ball rolls into the divot, you like spend 30 seconds to a minute just like staring angrily at the ball until someone notices it and they say like, what happened? And you're like, oh, yeah. It rolled into a divot. And you make this big fuss about how your ball's in a divot, which really throws your mind off. You're not going to hit a good shot once you spend all this time like getting angrier and angrier about the bad break. Mm-hmm. And then you hit the shot and you have this horrible follow through and you start pouting and, you know, whipping your club around. And then you angrily put your club back in your bag and kind of move on. When you probably actually could have hit a decent shot out of the divot if you didn't let it get to you so much. And so that's kind of like the point of golf is not to like hope that everything right happens to you. And like if that does, then you'll have a successful day. I think it's so much more important. Can you get to a place where you can embrace that these bad breaks and like the times you can't find your swing or the times your ball takes a bad bounce? Like this is all part of like what makes the game great and fun and enjoyable. And it kind of makes it this story or this journey that we can hopefully kind of get to the end of.
Yeah, I mean, it all goes back to golf being a mental game, too. I feel like as a girl, there's a little bit of extra pressure to do well because it really feels like a man's sport still. I mean, I'm a newer golfer. It's not like I've been playing since high school or something. So I definitely notice, like, if I'm playing with a group of people, that extra pressure to perform and say, like, hey, I'm a girl and I can play golf and look at me, you know, I'm doing this. Where sometimes then I end up hitting bad shots because that's all I'm trying to do is prove myself.
Do you think ever you're able to put it in perspective and see, like, how did I do at, like, conquering my own demons today?
I usually don't actually conquer them. I feel like I just play worse. The other day, I was playing like a week ago with my brother-in-law and his wife, and there's this shot at Canal Shores that's over the water. What hole is that?
It's either 9 or 16.
Number 9. Yeah, 9.
Yeah.
And there are these three guys just standing there, older men, really nice, you know, remind me of my uncle. And they're all kind of just waiting for us to play through. And they're like, all right, you going to try it? And I'm like, yeah. And so I go up there, and of course, these three guys, it's like, for some reason, it's as if there's 100 people watching me, and I just shank it. It doesn't go about 10 feet down the hill, and one of the guys, like, goes after it for me. I'm, like, so embarrassed. And then he's like, try it again, hit it again. And literally, all I wanted to do was get off that tee and just walk away. But I did try again, and it just went into the river. So, I mean, that day, if I'm really evaluating that round, I definitely just succumbed to the pressure there.
Yeah. Well, is there anything, what do you think you could do differently? I mean, it's hard to pretend that that doesn't exist.
I mean, you almost have to play, you almost have to just keep your cool and act like there's no one there, even when you know there is, because I don't know. Like, sometimes I think we can do an okay job tricking our minds. We can trick ourselves to thinking, like, hey, it's all good. Same shot. No big deal. Because I've hit it over there before. I've hit it over that creek before just fine. But that day, it just, for some reason, you know, my whole body was tense. The other thing is, like, in your body, too, you have a response. And if you can't relax, then you just can't relax sometimes.
Yeah. Do you find, there's, I think, two ways, two kind of like mindfulness schools of thought. And one is more of like when you have a bad or like a scary situation or a scary shot, you kind of do these like, you have these like maybe it's breathing exercises or it's like things you think about or it's a routine you go through that kind of makes you forget that those people are there or forget that you're scared or kind of focuses you on exactly what you're trying to do. Or there's kind of another way, which is more of, you look at it, the whole situation, a different perspective of where you can say, hey, if there weren't these kind of scary moments or these like, you know, heroic shot moments, like golf wouldn't even be that interesting. You wouldn't even play it in the first place. So it's kind of like, can you rise to the challenge? And that can be exciting because, I mean, you hit it into the creek twice. And so like, that's basically the worst thing that could happen. And you're still like fine. Like, you're not permanently scarred from that, are you?
I think, when I think back, I think I'm more scarred about the first tee at that course in Scotland when I hit it about 5 times and didn't hit it 10 feet.
You're making yourself sound like a really good golfer.
I mean,
do you ever hit any good shots?
You know, I'm just, I've had a lot of good shots. A lot of people say, wow, that's so pure. Mm. It's like, great job. You have a nice swing. Wow, she's a natural. So don't get me wrong. I do play pretty well, and that's why I keep going back to it. But there have been some traumatic moments in my past. I'm, I'm just thinking about right now.
Yeah. This brings us to our next quote, is that it's not what happens to us, it's what we do with it. So I think anyone who's played golf at a high level, or like who's ever been successful by whatever standards they judge success, they like understand this to some level, that they know they're going to get bad breaks. They know that sometimes their swing won't be there. They know that sometimes they're going to top it off the first hole. They know that sometimes they're going to hit it into the water, but they like, they don't let that bother them. And I think that it takes like experiencing these things over and over in order to kind of learn this. Like, you haven't been playing golf that long, you know, relatively.
Yeah. I think too, though, I mean, there needs to be more of an awareness of it too. Like, you can't just ignore it and keep moving on. I think that's what I normally do.
Is what?
Is just like feel upset, you know, for like 10 minutes. Oh, I couldn't hit it. Oh, I'm the worst. And then, but I don't really reflect and say, hey, that was a lot of pressure. And you know what? Next time you won't do that. So I don't think I follow the thought to the positive of what you're saying.
Yeah. It takes a long time. I used to be horrible at this. But I think it's part of what, since learning this or getting better at this, has made me kind of love golf even more, because I think golf kind of has the potential to put you in these situations where bad things happen to you over and over and over again. And you kind of see enough times that, oh, like, if I don't let this thing like weigh me down and eat away at me, like, I can get out to the other side of it. Like, if you see that enough, it kind of makes, I mean, it makes things like, you know, maybe in the best case scenario, like the virus, as bad as it is and as scary as it is, it makes you see that, like, oh, these things happen. And like, if you don't, it's like how you deal with it, right? You can't control what happens to you. You only can control like what you're going to do each day in response to it. You can control, like, are you going to sit and pout, or are you going to do whatever you do, you know, push-ups, or,
yeah, you know, get a little silly and make some quarantine jokes. That's what helps me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Because, like, when you're sitting at home right now, there's only certain things you can control. In golf, there's only certain things you can control. You can't control the outcome, really. But you can control kind of your preparation. You can control where your mind is at. One of the guys on our team at North Park, Braden, who he's been doing really bad the last year and a half, he came into spring break, and I kind of asked him what his goals or what his mindset was, and all he said was that, like, he just wanted to be as committed and prepared as he could for, like, every single shot. And he wasn't going to worry about the outcomes, and he wasn't going to get too in his head. He's just going to, one shot at a time, be as prepared and committed to every shot. He ended up, like, qualifying second on our team and finishing 13th out of 54 in the tournament we played, which is, like, he shot 75 on the second day. It was, like, really...
Yeah.
Like, he was shooting the 80s and 90s last year, so it's, like, way, like, a big comeback, all from just kind of that change in outlook.
A thought is just a thought. That's what my therapist has taught me. But we tend to give our thoughts a lot of power and control. So I think just remembering that a thought is just a thought. And it's, you know, you can just let it pass through. You don't have to respond to it every time.
Yeah. How can you actually, like, deal with that or actually put that into practice? I mean, you've just said yourself, like, whenever you have these thoughts, like, don't hit it in the water, you, like, can't get past it.
Well, you have to acknowledge it, so you have to obviously see it for what it is. You know, you hit a bad shot. Does that mean I'm a bad golfer? No. I hit one bad shot, and then you kind of can let it go after that. You kind of have to realize, like, what is the truth here? Because oftentimes, at least for me, like, my brain will spiral. If I'm, like, thinking I'm a bad golfer, well, then I can't hit anything, and I definitely can't chip the next one, and it just keeps going. So I think recognizing that your thoughts, you know, they carry a lot of power, but it's all about how you respond to them. Another thing I think about is, like, the advice that you would give to a friend is often different than the advice or the things that you tell yourself. So we're usually, like, kinder to our friends. We wouldn't say, like, oh, you're such a failure. Like, I can't believe you didn't hit that. We might say, hey, do you need another one? Like, take another shot. You know, we're kind of gentler, we're kinder with our friends. So maybe thinking about it from that perspective, like, what would I tell my friend in this situation?
That's great advice.
Could help.
Wow. You could be a golf coach.
Could help a lot of people today. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure what you need out there.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's getting to be a pretty good place to wrap up. So maybe, I mean, I'm sure not many people are going to go out and play golf today, but you can imagine hitting a bad shot, playing poorly, times when you can't putt, that this is kind of the point or the moment of the hero's journey where you're, like, called to make a choice. Like, you can call and you can change the way you respond to it, or you can pout and complain and blame the course and blame the clubs and blame other people. But if we're looking at it in a better way, we can... there's an opportunity to go out and do something better and to change and to live well and play well in the midst of all the bad things that are going on.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty nice. You can still get out and golf, you know, around here if you want. I mean, it's cold, but it's just being outdoors and getting out there.
Yeah. Well, all right. Jenny, thank you for being
clean
here.
Contact.
Yeah, wow.
I'll be That's back it. Again.
I hit it again.
A day or two.
Because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment. Or the moment defines you.
Well, here it comes.